Today is message 4 in our Christmas series we're calling The Impossible. And we've called it The Impossible because we've said that even as Christians, we need to be reminded that we serve the God of the impossible. We serve the God who can take any situation, who can take any circumstance, who can take any sorrow that we face and overcome it for our good and for His glory. But the main point of our text today, the big idea in the background today, is that we're to serve the God of the impossible, whether He does the impossible thing we want or not. We're to serve Him knowing that whether He does the impossible thing we want or not, He always does what is best and that He is with us in whatever we're facing. Our story begins on the plain of Dura in ancient Babylon. It's been roughly 260 years since the time of Elisha and Naaman. In the years since, the northern kingdom of Israel, where our story took place last week, has fallen to the Assyrians. Meanwhile, the southern kingdom of Judah staggers on for another 136 years or so, and then falls to the Babylonians, ruled by King Nebuchadnezzar. Among the first exiles taken from the southern kingdom are four men, either members of the royal family in Judah or sons of noblemen. There in Babylon, they rise to positions of prominence by the guidance and grace of God. One of these men is Daniel, for whom this book is named, and its author. The other three are renamed by the king and called Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. You'll hear their names a lot this morning. There are seven segments of our story that we're going to look at this morning. The first segment, which takes place in verses 1 through 7, prior to where, Kevin did read that. We're just going to call this first segment the unreasonable command. And as I read this segment, I want you to count, so you don't fall asleep, don't count sheep, but I want you to count how many times the text says that the king set up or raised up a golden image, all right? King Nebuchadnezzar made an image of gold whose height was 60 cubits and its breadth 6 cubits. He set it up on the plain of Dura in the province of Babylon. Then King Nebuchadnezzar sent to gather the satraps, the prefects, and the governors, the counselors, the treasurers, the justices, the magistrates, and all the officials of the province to come to the dedication of the image that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. Then the satraps, the prefects, and the governors, the counselors, the treasurers, the justices, the magistrates, and all the officials of the provinces gathered for the dedication of the image that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. And they stood before the image that Nebuchadnezzar had set up. Verse 4, and the herald proclaimed aloud, "You are commanded, O peoples, nations, and languages, that when you hear the sound of the horn, pipe, lyre, trigon, harp, bagpipe, and every kind of music, you are to fall down and worship the golden image that King Nebuchadnezzar has set up. And whoever does not fall down and worship shall immediately be cast into a burning, fiery furnace." Therefore, kind of obviously, I suppose, as soon as all the peoples heard the sound of the horn, pipe, lyre, trigon, harp, bagpipe, and every kind of music, all the peoples, nations, and languages fell down and worshiped the golden image that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. Okay, how many times did you count? Okay, 5 or 6, right? Okay, hold that thought. This image the king has set up, it's probably not solid gold, right? I don't think there's enough gold in the whole kingdom for that. It's probably made of wood and overlaid with gold, so it's gold-plated. Still, at a height that translates to 90 feet tall and a width of 9 feet, that's still a lot of surface area to cover with gold. It must have looked amazing in the sunlight. Speaking of those dimensions, 90 feet by 9 feet, that might sound too tall and narrow. It might seem strange dimensions for a statue. But while for that reason some have thought this image is actually some sort of pillar or maybe an obelisk like they set up in Egypt, the word for image here usually means a human form. So this wouldn't have to mean it's a freakishly thin human statue. Part of that 90 feet of height could have been made up of a large base or a pedestal with the image, presumably, of King Nebuchadnezzar high on top. Now, if you're jumping into this book the way we are this morning, it would be really easy to miss what many believe is the underlying sort of catalyst for the setting up of this golden image in the first place, which is that in the chapter before, we have Daniel interpreting King Nebuchadnezzar's dream about a great statue he has seen, an image mighty and of exceeding brightness. Daniel had told the king in that chapter that the head of the image in his dream, which was made of gold, represented him. It represented Nebuchadnezzar, his own kingdom, his own rule. But the rest of the statue, which was made up of different sections and different materials, it represented other lesser kingdoms that would come after him in history. And in his dream, all of this was followed by a great stone cut from a mountain by no human hand, which came and broke in pieces the whole statue. In other words, it broke in pieces all the kingdoms of men. And Daniel says this is a picture of the coming kingdom of God. And so whether chapter 3 of Daniel comes days or years after this dream in chapter 2, what seems clear is that Nebuchadnezzar has already forgotten the humbling point of that dream. He seems to have forgotten that as great as he is, there is a king far greater who has given him the power he has and who can just as easily take it away. He seems to have forgotten all this, and instead of honoring, instead of raising up the God of heaven, we're told 5 or 6 times at the beginning of chapter 3 that he raised up an image, presumably of himself, to be honored and worshipped instead. The repetition of that fact is the storyteller's way of emphasizing something, which in this case is the great foolishness of the pagan king. This king who, instead of making just the head out of gold, has gone and made the whole thing out of gold. This king who, instead of being content to be a footnote in the coming of God's kingdom, has sought to set his rule as the kingdom to end all kingdoms. And so he summons all the important officials of his vast conquered realm to come back to Babylon and to the dedication of the image that represents his own greatness. Back to Babylon, where the ancient Tower of Babel once went up, and the words of its builders, to make a name for ourselves. It's why Babel and Babylon is made a symbol of sin, a symbol of the enemy of God and his people all throughout the Bible. Because it's a picture of what takes place at some point in every human heart. Instead of honoring God's name and making him famous, as one author writes, the human soul wants to build a tower to the sky to rival God. Every human soul wants this. Every single one. Yours does too, or has at least at some point. It's part of the twisting effect of sin that creatures who are made to worship their creator turn inward to lift themselves up instead. When I worked in construction for 3 years, I never saw a clean job site. They don't exist. There were always tools everywhere. There were materials everywhere. The signs of construction were everywhere. And the same thing is true in our lives. Every time you know what God says and you ignore it, it's the sign of construction in your soul. Every time I know something is sin and I do it anyway, it's the sign of construction in my soul. It's you saying to God, I'll do it my way. It's me saying to God, I know better. It's us rebuilding Babel. But if a heart is to be made ready to receive the true King of heaven, God must tear that high place down. Every valley shall be lifted up, and every mountain and hill be made low. The uneven ground shall become level, and the rough places a plain, and the glory of the Lord shall be revealed, and all flesh shall see it together, for the mouth of the Lord has spoken. That is a prophecy of Isaiah about what must be done to prepare the hearts of God's people for their king. And that's what John the Baptist is used to do to prepare hearts for Jesus. He wasn't a soft preacher. He preached the kind of messages that would tear down mountains. And as Christians, as God's people who have received their King, if our hearts are to remain soft toward God, we must keep tearing down those towers too. We must do this daily by confessing our sin to God instead of hiding it, instead of justifying it. You know, this pattern, this theme of tearing down the high places of the heart is a pattern played out all throughout the Bible in the lives of countless individuals. And King Nebuchadnezzar is one of them. Because as a mere man, this is the proud, unreasonable command that he's now given. You are to fall down and worship the golden image that King Nebuchadnezzar has set up, and whoever does not fall down and worship shall immediately be cast into a burning fiery furnace. The command essentially is this: fall down before the image of Nebuchadnezzar and worship, or fall down into the furnace and be burned up. It's a command that is the overflow of a proud and high heart that must be torn down. The problem is that at the end of Daniel chapter 2, after Daniel had interpreted the king's dream, he'd also put in a good word, you remember, for his three friends, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who were then appointed over the affairs of the province of Babylon. Well, what that means is that they've now been swept up in this summons and are expected to worship this image as well. But of course, as devout Jews, they cannot do it. As men of God, they cannot do it. It's a violation of the first and second commandments. You shall have no other gods before me or besides me. You shall not make for yourself a carved image or any likeness of anything that is in heaven above or that is on the earth beneath or that is in the water under the earth. You shall not bow down to them or serve them. And so when the manipulative worship music plays and when everyone else bows down, these three do not. It reminds me of the trailer for the new Superman movie I watched this week. One of the ways the director draws attention to Superman, even though he's disguised in the clip as the dorky Clark Kent, one of the ways he draws attention to him is by showing how tall he is compared to everyone else in the Metropolis crowd that's walking down the sidewalk. He's like head and shoulders above everyone else. So he really sticks out. But not as much as these guys do when everyone on the plain of Dura bows while they stay standing. Friends, faith in God and his word will always make you stand out in a crowd. Faith, writes Warren Wiersbe, means obeying God regardless of the feelings within us, the circumstances around us, or the consequences before us. Which brings us to the second segment of our story, the underhanded accusation, we'll call it. Look with me now at verses 8 through 12. Therefore, at that time, certain Chaldeans came forward and maliciously accused the Jews. They declared to King Nebuchadnezzar, "O king, live forever. You, O king, have made a decree that every man who hears the sound of the horn, pipe, lyre, trigon, harp, bagpipe, and every kind of music shall fall down and worship the golden image." I had to laugh. J. Vernon McGee, in his commentary, says at this point, I think he's being sarcastic. He says, this must have been a very famous orchestra in that day. This is the third time we have been given the list of instruments, he says. And whoever does not fall down and worship shall be cast into a burning fiery furnace. Verse 12. There are certain Jews whom you have appointed over the affairs of the province of Babylon, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. These men, O king, pay no attention to you. They do not serve your gods or worship the golden image that you have set up. Yep, faith in God and his word will always make you stand out in a crowd, and sometimes, just like the nail that stands out, that will mean you get targeted for hammering down. Chaldean is a reference to nationality, so technically the Chaldeans were a culture that was absorbed by and into the kingdom of Babylonia, but the term is sort of used almost as a synonym for the native Babylonians. And so the Chaldeans here are the more native members of King Nebuchadnezzar's court, as opposed to the Jews who are clearly foreigners and strangers. And once again, if we were reading through from chapter 2, it might at first seem strange to us that these Chaldeans would be turning on the Jewish men, since since it was a Jewish man named Daniel who had just saved the Chaldeans of the royal court from another of Nebuchadnezzar's unreasonable commands just one chapter earlier. So they've just been saved by a Jewish man, and now they're turning on these Jewish men. But you know what? Jealousy and pride are powerful motivators. Yes, Daniel saved their lives, but his success with the king's dream also sort of highlighted their failure. And on top of that, as Calvin puts it, it's likely they were indignant at strangers being made prefects while they stayed in the same positions or even lost favor in the eyes of the king. And so it seems that at least some of them, the text says certain Chaldeans, and refers to their accusations as malicious, it seems that at least some of them are now trying to get even or get back what they think they rightly deserve. It's even possible that this whole idea of the golden image was theirs in the first place. That they've played off the king's dream, you know, they've heard about this dream, and so they're playing off his dream and they're playing on his vanity, all to entrap these men that they can't stand. Because it almost seems, when you're reading this, like they're waiting for this to happen. Like they're expecting it. Like they're watching for it and hoping for it. After all, who do these Jews think they are to disobey the king? Don't they know they're living in exile? Well, friends, there's a sense in which we're living in exile too, isn't there? While this is our Father's world, it is true that until we die or Christ returns, our bodies and our relationships and our whole lives will not only still be affected by the corrupting influences and pressures of sin, but will also be intentionally targeted by the influences and pressures of sin. I'm sure we can all think of ways the unbelieving world pushes back against God's people to get them to bend the knee, even today, to obey men instead of God, to fall down and worship a lie instead of the truth. We must not do it. We cannot do it. And when we do, we must quickly repent and stand back up again for what is true. When I was in college, I was on a bicycle team. I've told you this before. We rode across the U.S., and we brought with us some rain ponchos in case of weather. We figured it might rain once or twice as we were riding across the U.S. Well, they worked great to keep you dry, but they also worked great as sails. When we rode forward, you know, especially if there was a headwind, the wind would catch those ponchos and create a drag, like a little parachute, and would slow us down. They were the bane of our existence. They would slow us down as we pedaled. And that's what life in a fallen world is like too, even for Christians. Yes, we have the Holy Spirit who comes like a tailwind and can overcome any headwind in our lives, but until we die or until Jesus comes, we live in exile where the headwinds of a Babylon world will come in different forms, both inside and out, to push against us and wear us down. And so our job is to trust God while in exile. That's our job, to choose to lean on His truth and His promises and His word that are applied by His Spirit in order to keep us moving forward against the wind. We are to trust God instead of yielding to the pressure, instead of going along with the flow of the world, the flesh, or the devil in acts of compromise. Our job in exile is to say with Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, "As for me and my house, we will serve the Lord." Our job in exile is to raise a home, it's to raise a family, it's to raise the quality of life for those around us, and all the while to be raising up in honor and worship the name of our great God who will one day cause every wind of opposition to cease. We looked first at the unreasonable command, then the underhanded accusation. Now we come to the unwitting challenge. Look with me now at verses 13 through 15. Then Nebuchadnezzar, in furious rage, commanded that Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego be brought. So they brought these men before the king. Nebuchadnezzar answered and said to them, "Is it true, O Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, that you do not serve my gods or worship the golden image that I have set up? Now, if you are ready, when you hear the sound of the horn, pipe, lyre, trigon, harp, bagpipe, and every kind of music, to fall down and worship the image that I have made, well and good. But if you do not worship, you shall immediately be cast into a burning, fiery furnace. And who is the God who will deliver you out of my hands? What we find again and again is that when rulers and kings challenge God, when they assume he's just like their own gods, the God of Israel accepts the challenge as an opportunity to bring distinction and honor to himself. We remember how in Exodus chapter 5, when Moses and Aaron first went before Pharaoh and told him that the Lord said, "Let my people go," how the Pharaoh answered, "Who is the Lord that I should obey his voice and let Israel go? I do not know the Lord, and moreover, I will not let Israel go." Well, 10 devastating plagues later, all of Egypt is in tatters, and the Pharaoh knew who the Lord was. We remember how in Isaiah 36, the armies of Assyria had surrounded Jerusalem to conquer it, and how their commander had taunted the people on the walls and mocked God, saying, "Beware lest Hezekiah mislead you by saying, 'The Lord will deliver us.' Has any of the gods of the nations delivered his land out of the hand of the king of Assyria? Where are the gods of Hamath and Arpad? Where are the gods of Sepharvaim? Have they delivered Samaria out of my hand? Who among all the gods of these lands have delivered their lands out of my hand, that the Lord should deliver Jerusalem out of my hand?" Well, a few days later, the angel of the Lord had killed 85,000 of the Assyrian commander's soldiers. And when the king of Assyria fled home, he was murdered by his own sons while worshiping in the temple of his own God. Don't miss that, because it's almost as if the Lord has said back to him his own words, "Has any of the gods of the nations delivered them out of my hand?" And now it's Nebuchadnezzar's turn. "Who is the God who will deliver you out of my hands?" he asks. Such reckless blasphemy. Such an unwitting invitation for rebuke. Before the end of his life, he will learn exactly who this God is. Until he bends the knee, until he falls down and worships, God will tear down his kingdom and even his sanity. Until he remembers that he, like all governing authorities on earth, is a servant of God and not the other way around. Until he learns that the Most High rules the kingdom of men and gives it to whom he will. Until he learns that those who walk in pride, God is able to humble. But first, on this day, he will learn something that Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego already know, that their God is the God who can certainly do the impossible and deliver them out of his hands. We've looked at the unreasonable command, then the underhanded accusation, the unwitting challenge. Now we come to the undaunted choice.